Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, September 30th, 2020. A senior UN diplomat says South Sudan's peace agreement is not moving anywhere.
The cabinet is meeting irregularly, and people tell me that they would like to see the president and the vice presidents meeting more often and more closely together.
And a South Sudanese refugee scores high marks in Sudan's primary school exams.
It was difficult for me because I was supposed to go to primary 3 in South Sudan in English. But when we arrived here, I could not understand lessons in Arabic.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A senior UN official in Juba says South Sudan's peace process is what he called limping, as forces at the training centers continue to desert due to lack of basic necessities, including food. The chief of the United Nations mission in South Sudan says urgent action is needed to put the peace process back on track. David Shaira, who is also the special representative of the United Nations Secretary General in South Sudan, says the mission is disappointed that the government blocked its peacekeepers from deploying in Lobonok amidst escalating violence. For VOA News, Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
And Ms. Boss David Shaira says South Sudan's leaders have been slow in implementing the peace agreement, with some key activities stuck in neutral.
The cabinet is meeting irregularly, and people tell me that they would like to see the president and the vice presidents meeting more often and more closely together. The transitional National Legislative Assembly is yet to be reconstituted, so necessary new laws are not being passed and progress on the constitution has been delayed. Critically, there has been no movement on the area of security sector reform.
Shaira, who recently returned to Juba from New York, where he briefed the UN Security Council on the situation in South Sudan, says forces that were supposed to be trained, unified, and deployed are losing hope. He says they are deserting training centers and going back to their villages due to a lack of basic necessities.
As a result of lack of food and of logistics and other things being supplied to these training centres, people are starting to leave and move back. This is worrying on a couple of levels. First of all, because people are being disillusioned with the fact that it hasn't continued on, and that's disillusionment is never a good thing. It leads to frustration and anger and possibly violence. And it also means that a number of people who were there with the promise of joining the armed forces are now going back to their villages, or perhaps en route to villages, and could cause further instability on the ground as well.
Shaira says further delays in implementing the peace deal risk delaying elections beyond the timeline is stipulated in the peace deal, something he says will deny South Sudanese an opportunity to choose their leaders. He says urgent action is needed to move the peace process forward.
We really do need to urgently breathe new life into the peace process. The international community and regional partners play an important role, but the parties themselves must also step up their efforts to regain lost momentum.
While the peace process limps along, the UN chief says the country's military has changed its approach in dealing with UN peacekeepers, who he says were blocked from deploying in civilian areas that are under threat. Last month, the South Sudan government blocked UN peacekeepers from deploying 92 troops in Lobonok, approximately 120 kilometers southeast of Juba town, where violence has escalated after government forces clashed with National Salvation Front rebel forces loyal to Thomas Cirilo, according to Shaira.
For a number of years, we've had an agreement to notify the South Sudan authorities when our peacekeepers move around the countries. We do this because we have a respect for the sovereignty of South Sudan. However, there is no sign of similar respect from the SSPDF for our need to have freedom of movement to protect civilians and to build peace. As a result, we've had to report these persistent obstructions to regional and international players, including the Security Council and the African Union. It tarnishes the reputation of the SSPDF and it will have knock-on effects into other areas of cooperation.
SSPDF spokesperson Lul Rai Kwong strongly denied that charge, saying there was insufficient time given for communication regarding the movement of peacekeepers to Lobonok.
What had happened on that day, yes, they were given permission, but there was no sufficient time for our forces to be notified in advance. And as a result, when they were headed there, they were stopped. And as usual, they were asked about where they were going. And when they produced evidence showing that they were given permission, the only thing that was done at that particular checkpoint was them to stop for a minute so that the commanding officer could establish communication with the SSPDF headquarters. And it was at that point that they started reporting that they were being denied access to Lebanon.
Shira says the fact is South Sudan security reforms have not moved past the first stage where forces are trained and graduate from training facilities. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
A South Sudanese refugee excelled in Sudan's primary living examination, scoring the second highest marks in the country. Mavet Hakim Kur, who fled violence from her hometown of Reng in Upper Nile State in South Sudan in 2014, scored 278 out of 280. Kur praised her parents for supporting her in the past few years. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
15-year-old South Sudanese Mervet Hakim Kur scored the second highest marks in the primary living examination of Khartoum State this year. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus by phone from the Umbada neighborhood of Omdurman town, Mervet says she was happy to learn she did so well in her examinations. As a refugee, she says it was not easy to enroll in Sudan's public schools. Mervet feels it was even more of an achievement this year, considering students had to spend months inside due to the COVID-19 pandemic.
We spent more than 3 months in the house during the COVID-19 lockdown, and we even forgot about the studies. Some of us lost hope in the examination. To our surprise, the exam was announced in short notice, and we could not believe to study only for 2 weeks period to the exam. So I was worried.
More than 125,000 students sat for the primary examination this year across Khartoum State. Mervet fled violence in 2014 from Upper Nile State's Rang town along with her family of 13. She says she faced challenges enrolling in schools due to language issues.
It was difficult for me because I was supposed to go to primary 3 in South Sudan in English. But when we arrived here, I could not understand lessons in Arabic. So my mom decided for me to repeat the same class. She used to teach us at home with Arabic alphabets, and I was able to pick up, and here we are.
Mervet says she dedicates what she calls a humble success to the thousands of South Sudanese girls who do not have access to education due to the conflict at home. Mervet says she hopes to become a medical doctor and return to South Sudan someday and help in developing her country. She notes that will become reality only if South Sudanese leaders are able to silence the guns and give girls an opportunity.
This is wrong practice. We cannot marry out a girl while she is not educated and she does not know how to behave at home. Parents need to allow their young girls to finish their studies and let us help them achieve their dreams.
45-year-old Teresa Marcelo Laku, Mervet's stepmother, says she is very proud of Mervet and calls her high score a success not only for the whole family but for the entire South Sudanese nation. Marcelo says she will do what she can to make sure Mervet realizes her dreams of becoming a physician.
She raised up our heads as family members and the whole of South Sudan. We are honored to hear such news. This is an honor to us as family and to South Sudan as a country.
Mervet called on her fellow South Sudanese who might have been facing challenges of language issues to keep on working hard and achieve their dreams. Nothing is impossible, Let them work hard and they will make it, she said. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Still on refugee issues, a South Sudanese refugee living in Canada who has been appointed as an advisor to the Canadian delegation to 2020 meeting of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugee Executive Committee says life in the West is full of struggles. Malwal Bolkir says refugees looking for a third country solution should prepare for any conditions.
My advice to the one person who might think that resettlement to any country is the best. So it depends on whatever they need the resettlement for. Of course, it could be a priority for some of the refugees. I cannot say that resettlement is not important. Resettlement is actually very important because when people are being resettled, it's not because they want to be resettled. You know, sometimes they had like serious issues that led them to be resettled into those third countries. So I think it is very important that also these states put into consideration the fact that there is need to resettle refugees that are in need of resettlement or that are not safe in the hosting countries and are not also safe to go back to their country. But at the same time, it is also very important to look at what is good for other refugees that might not necessarily have a bigger problem in the hosting countries. But if there is an issue of safety among the refugees within the hosting countries, it is really, really very crucial that they have to be resettled. And Canada will continue, I think, because they're really very great champion for refugees. They will continue to bring in refugees who really have, who are really not safe in the hosting countries and are not safe to go back to their original country too.
How is your experience like when you were resettled to Canada? I'm sure you have colleagues and friends at the refugee camps who could be interested in hearing your story. And you know what? A lot of refugees think that Canada or US is what they see in the movie. What is your experience like?
Interestingly, I've been in Canada before I moved to Canada as a resident. I've been to Canada before. But it is true, there are people who might think that these countries are like the way they see the movie. So these countries, they're just like the countries that we are from. There are a few differences because they have better services, of course, which we could have if we have like a better governance in our countries. So, but they're not like they see in the movies because here there's also struggle. As soon as they come here, they also have to struggle to live their life and to continue to have a dignified life. So if they don't struggle from where they are, they will not be able to struggle from here because life is about endeavoring to always be the best of who you, bring the best of who you are.
I know life in the West is all about paying your bills and keeping up with, you know, your work schedule and programming yourself so that you are not affected in one way or another. What would you tell your colleagues or your friends in refugee camps who think once you land in US, their church is waiting to take care of you and pay your bills and do everything for you, send you to school and stuff like that, just because you come from a conflict-prone area?
No. To the contrary, those that are being resettled don't actually get a scholarship.
But the perception in Africa is that when you come from a war-ravaged country, there is sympathy for you. There is an, if you like, prima facie sympathy for you and you are taken care of.
Oh, definitely no. So when you arrive in these countries, you have to really work hard. Work hard to pay your bills, work hard to provide for yourself. And if you have family, you also work hard to provide and to provide for your family and for yourself. And both for education and all the other bills. There are more bills. Actually, there are more bills here than there too. personally, I am okay with my bill. But that doesn't mean that I don't struggle. So I had to sweat to also make sure that I cover for my bills.
That's Malwal Bolkir, the refugee advisor to the Canadian delegation to the UNHCR 2020 Executive Committee meeting. He spoke with me from Kitchener on Monday. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, World Health Organization vows to punish unprofessional behavior in DRC. Find out why after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how do you reward yourself?
I'll go and buy myself maybe a pair of shoes I always desire to get. I'll go and have a meal I always desire to get. Or anything. Depends on what I've achieved.
By spoiling myself. I'm a girl. I go buy myself clothes, shoes, do my hair, my nails. Basic things that will make me look good and happy at the end of the day.
I cook a good meal. I sit down with a chill drink.
My work involves very hard work, so I get very tired. So I reward myself once every month. I do that by swimming and relaxing at the beach with my family.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
VOA always delivers your favorite programs, news, music, entertainment, and sports shows. Starting Monday, October 5th, our flagship news show, South Sudan in Focus, will be moving to 16:30 UTC, followed by your favorite sports show, The Sunny Side of Sports, at 1700 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. The World Food Programme reports about 70,000 people are severely affected by unprecedented flooding in South Sudan. Jonglei State, the worst affected area, is also facing serious food shortages, with more than 1.4 million people going hungry. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Nearly half of South Sudan is underwater. The World Food Programme reports entire villages, homes, and farmlands in 36 counties are submerged. It says the situation is particularly dire in Jonglei State, where one-third of the country's 700,000 flood victims live. WFP Country Director in South Sudan, Matthew Hollingworth, says 85,000 people have been displaced by the flooding, which has disrupted trade routes, damaged crops, killed livestock, and submerged houses.
This flooding crisis is coming on top of a very grim hunger situation in Jonglei, where already this year 1.4 million people were suffering from acute and severe hunger, in addition to over 300,000 children under five who are acutely malnourished.
Hollingworth says tackling the humanitarian needs of the flood victims is particularly difficult in the midst of increasing violence and COVID-19-related economic and health crises. This year's torrential rains began well before the water from last year's flooding had fully receded. Aid workers fear the flooding is likely to be even more severe when the so-called normal rainy season starts. Hollingworth says there are very worrying signs of deepening hunger in a country which has seen 31 pockets of famine in the past 5 years.
We've yet to get data back to confirm how bad it will be, but I think we all need to prepare ourselves that we must do everything in our power to avoid famine and to avoid the levels of hunger, the catastrophic hunger that we've seen sadly in the past in this country.
WFP currently is providing food aid to 300,000 people. It is scaling up its life-saving operation to support 700,000 flood-affected people who have lost their harvests and livelihoods. The agency is appealing for $58 million for the coming 6 months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
From Geneva, we move back to Juba, where South Sudan's General Education Ministry says schools will reopen on October 5th. The Minister for General Education, Awut Deng Achuel, says schools will be expected to respect COVID-19 preventative measures, including social distancing and regular hand washing. Deng says the government will provide money to schools to implement the measures, but did not disclose the amount of the money the government will provide for such activities. For VOA News, Wake Simon Udu reports from Juba.
Minister Deng told the reporters during a media briefing in Juba this morning that schools will reopen under a new school calendar designed to enable candidates to prepare for their final examinations and the regular school week be lengthened.
In order to cover syllabus and satisfactorily prepare the learners for the final leaving examination, the academic year will be extended to February. Also, the timetable for lessons has been designed for 6 days a week, from Monday to Saturday.
Deng says her ministry is preparing to reopen classes for 75,000 primary 8 pupils and 35,000 senior 4 students across the country in October. She says primary 8 candidates are scheduled to take the primary certificate examinations, or CPE, in early February 2021, while senior 4 students will sit for their certificates of secondary examination, or CSE, examinations in the third week of March next year. Usually, both primary and secondary schools open for the new academic year in February, which runs for 3 terms through December. Next year, Deng says both primary and secondary schools will start the first term of the new school year on April 5th. Deng says she has directed General Education and Instruction Ministry staff and National Examination Council officials to implement the phased reopening of schools across the country. Deng acknowledges reopening schools under the current circumstances will not be easy, but says it will be handled with caution.
If there is any signal that the situation is not correct, we cannot risk the life of our children. A decision will be made promptly.
Deng says school administrators should adhere to all health ministry protocols, including social distancing, disinfecting classrooms, providing water, sanitation, and hygiene facilities, including water tanks, sanitizers, and a shop. To enforce social distancing, classes will be split into small sizes, and students, teachers, and support staff should be provided with personal protective equipment, according to Deng. In order to do all that, Deng admits there are several economic challenges that lie ahead.
We need to work with the leadership of the country. Particularly the Council of Ministers, to ensure that these resources are available for our examination. It's this key that we facilitate.
While Deng says the Education Ministry will provide schools with the facilities to cap the transmission of the virus, she could not say how much money the government has allocated to schools for that purpose.
We know who's doing what at the same time. Government has also been availing resources and in line with that to make sure that things which are not everything, but the crucial things that are needed for reopening are available.
In a statement released today, UNICEF welcomed the reopening of South Sudanese schools. Mohamed Ayoya, UNICEF's representative in South Sudan, said in the statement, quote, "Our entire team is mobilized and working with the Ministry of General Education and Instruction, as well as all other concerned line ministries and partners, to help making the reopening of school a smooth process," end of quote. COVID-19 cases have dropped significantly across South Sudan compared to some months back. Confirmed cases continue to be reported each day. South Sudan's overall reported number of deaths linked to COVID-19 remains low, 49. To date, the country has registered 2,704 positive cases of COVID-19 nationwide, including 1,438 recoveries. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
World Health Organization says it is outraged by allegations of women in DRC being forced to trade sex for jobs in the organization's Ebola operation. A WHO spokesperson tells VOA an investigation is underway to identify the perpetrators of this abuse, adding serious disciplinary measures will be taken against those found guilty of those crimes. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Health Agency says it is outraged by these allegations. It says it has a zero-tolerance policy with regard to sexual exploitation and abuse and plans a thorough investigation to get to the bottom of this totally unacceptable behavior. An investigation by the New Humanitarian and the Thomson Reuters Foundation found more than 50 women were forced to trade sex for a job in the international Ebola aid operation in eastern DRC. The women have accused male aid workers from the World Health Organization and leading non-governmental organizations of abusing them. WHO spokeswoman Fadela Shaib tells VOA an investigation will seek to uncover the identities of the men who reportedly abused the women and determine whether the allegations are true.
If WHO staff, partners, or contractors are guilty of this allegation, WHO will take firm decision, disciplinary decision against them, immediate dismissal, or we can end our contracts with contractors or consultants.
Much of the alleged abuse reportedly occurred in the eastern city of Beni, which was the epicenter of a nearly two-year-long Ebola epidemic that killed 2,229 people before it ended in June. WHO currently is tackling another Ebola outbreak in Equateur province. The virus so far has infected 112 people, including 48 deaths. Shaib says WHO's director general takes the allegations of sexual abuse seriously and has ordered an immediate, thorough, and transparent investigation.
We are there to help vulnerable population, including women, and we will not tolerate this behavior from staff, contractors, or partners. Only the investigation will tell us who these perpetrators are, and we will do an investigation and go public about our findings.
WHO has many policies and mechanisms in place, including mandatory training programs to prevent sexual abuse. It also has set up hotlines where victims can report violations and seek help. Shaib says WHO recognizes even the best policies can go awry. She says every year, WHO reports to the member states all misconduct about which it is informed, including fraud, corruption, and sexual abuse. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We will keep you in DRC with the song Nzambe ya Sekele by Moise Matuta.
Sambwa sekele ndé pour moi mon Christ respiration à moi l'Nzambe c'est la prière
We've been listening to Moise Matuta with the song Nzambe ya Sekele. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask if you must leave your home. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because There's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.